This is the clown show.
How's that going, noob?
Oh man, I am a little run down. All right, here we go. This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 282, where today CJ and I are going to talk about the Microsoft Connect event and how Microsoft ditched their browser Edge and more cloud news, recorded live December the 6th, 2018. Inbox Zero is a thing of the past. We're also inundated with email, and that's where Sanebox comes in. Think of it as an EMT for your email. As messages flow in, Sanebox does the triage for you. Sane later sifts through all the distracting stuff out of your inbox so that you can focus only on the important emails. And that's just a taste. It also has nifty features like the Sane Black Hole and Sane Reminders. And best of all, you can use Sanebox with any email client or phone anywhere you check your email. See how Sanebox can magically remove distractions from your inbox with a free 2-week trial. Visit sanebox.com/MSCloudShow today to start your free trial and get a $25 credit.
Hey, CJ.
How you doing?
I'm a little tired, as you can tell from that intro. I kind of muffled it a little bit.
Is this the first time you're doing this?
You know, I like that we do the bloopers. A friend of mine was talking to me the other day, and she's like, she was listening to our the episode when I had thrown my back out like in the last couple of weeks, and I sneezed during the episode. She said she was driving down the road. She about spit coffee all over the place and had a wreck because she was like almost laughing at me, but like feeling sympathy. She's like, I know how that feels.
Brutal. Yeah.
So I gotta go back and listen to it. But hey, man, a little reset here. How are you doing today?
I am pretty good. I am back from vacation and feeling pretty good. So it was a great trip and really nice break. Really nice to get away. We had 8 families go with us, and so there was a big group of people, and we called it the migrant caravan going the other way.
Jesus.
There was so many. God. There was so many of us.
That is so wrong.
It really is wrong. But it was a great trip. We had a really fun time, and it was super nice, just so relaxing. It's not a touristy thing. All we do is really go down and just chill out. Like, we go nowhere. We don't go see anything. We don't go do anything. We just sit on the beach, chill, build sandcastles, drink cocktails. I went for a sail a few times. Mm. And it's really just my mental reset for the year. And it was great. And, of course, I come back and I've got to unpack a new house that we moved into that we've only... We were only in for like 3 or 4 days before we left to go to Mexico. So I'll come back to an absolute bomb site of a house. So I've got to take care of that.
Yeah, I remember when you were leaving, I was like, man, oh God, you're going to have to know that you got to come back to that. That's not going to be fun.
Yeah, I spent last night patching unterminated Ethernet cables all around the house and was swearing black and blue at one point. Because, you know, as you know, I posted this on Facebook, which I think you laughed at or something, which was, I said, question, if you have 12 unterminated, unpatched Ethernet cables and you're trying to find which one goes to your office in your house, how many Ethernet cables do you have to terminate and patch before to find the one that goes to your office? What's the correct answer, AC? You should know this.
So I actually was impressed that it was only 12 for you.
Yeah.
Because for me, when I was doing that, I had about like 16 or 17 because I come to find that, oh, this one was poorly done and I have to redo it.
Tell. I redid one once. So I think I patched 13. Yeah. So the correct answer is always 12, right? Because it's always the last one. And some smart ass on Facebook, I won't name him, said, oh, you should have picked the last one first. Yeah, thanks. That's really helpful. Yeah,
that really helps. Yeah, I appreciate. Yeah, that's cool. Well, yeah, you are. It's got to be nice to be nice, and I guess in one sense, you come back after a vacation like that, and you're totally refreshed. But then you're like, all right, now you got to set the alarm. You got to get the kids off to school. You got to get into work and get back to the grind. You're like, oh, this sucks.
I tell you what, like, there's a lot to that comment about the alarm, right? Like, for 10 days, I didn't wake up to an alarm, and naturally waking up, man, you feel so much better.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. I'm trying to figure out, how do I do that here? I'm not sure. Probably requires going to bed a lot earlier.
You know, it's funny because you hear people say that, and then what their response is like, I just have to own my own company. And I guess you can say, nope, it doesn't work that way.
That really doesn't help at all. Yeah. How about you? Where are you in the world right now?
Hard to keep track of. So the last one. Yeah, I left the day after Thanksgiving in the U.S. Which, like, I left like what, a day or two after you left for Mexico. Mm. I flew over to Copenhagen, Denmark, for the European SharePoint conference. I did that for a week and had a workshop, had a pair of breakout sessions. Really good experience though. It's a lot of fun. Great show. Actually, was pretty humbled. I was awarded the top workshop speaker. They do like a survey of everybody that was doing the workshops, and I was awarded the top one. So of course, nice. I knew they were doing the award, but I didn't know when they were giving it out. And when they gave it out, they were doing a keynote, because they do a lot of keynotes. They do like one or two keynotes each morning and one in the afternoon. And I was there for the first days of keynotes, but I didn't know that there was a second days of keynotes. And so I chose to sleep in. And so when my name is being called out to be given this nice piece of glass for an award in front of 2,000 people, I was sleeping. I was like, my bad. I didn't know that. I didn't know that was going on. I felt so bad. But it was really good. You know, it was a great experience. It was a great venue. It was nice to be presenting to an audience that I don't normally get to present to.
Yeah.
And interact with that environment, interact with, you know, developers over in Europe. So I really enjoyed it. I did have one funny experience. They did this speaker picture. And after the speaker picture, Chris O'Brien from England and I were just hanging out talking for a second. And this guy comes up and he's like, can I get a picture with you guys? So I'm like, yeah, yeah, sure. So he takes a picture. I'm like, you know, so where are you from? Jacksonville, Florida. I'm like, no. I said, no kidding. That's crazy. You're originally from Jacksonville, Florida. Where do you live now? And he goes, Jacksonville, Florida. I'm like, you came all the way over here for this conference? I'm like, he's like, yeah, I would really want to get a picture with you. I'm like, dude, we could have gotten a coffee. Yeah. We live in the same city.
We live in the same city. I think going quarter way around the globe is kind of overkill for that.
Yeah, exactly. A bit. But yeah, we had a good time. It was fun. And then.
That's so funny. That's pretty cool, though. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was. And I was there for a week. Gave out a lot of our t-shirts. They flew off the racks, which was nice. And on the last day of that conference, or the day after it ended on a Friday, I flew back to the US, straight to Columbia, South Carolina. Was there from Friday until Sunday for my kids in a real big swim meet. And then on Sunday, flew up to Chicago, where I am right now, for the SharePoint Fest Chicago conference. So we're sitting here on day 4 of the conference. Mm-hmm. I'll do a live podcast later today. I've got 2 more breakout sessions. I've got a pretty heavy load here. I had a full day workshop, had a half day workshop session, and then I've had a session every day. So I've been pretty darn busy, and I'm very much looking forward to going home tomorrow and not traveling for about 2.5 months.
Yeah, you're just going to get through this talking thing and then you can not talk for a while. I bet you're looking forward to that.
I very much am. I very much am.
Excellent.
Hey man, there's a lot of stuff has happened. And I know we took a week off last week because we had just with travel and everything, it was too hard for us to kind of get things sorted. So we didn't have an episode that we published last week, but we wanted to get together this week because, man, a lot of stuff has been going on in the Microsoft world in the last whatever couple days.
Big news.
Oh my God. We've had, you know, there's the Microsoft Connect event. There's a vulnerability that came out. There's some news about the Chromium or with the Edge browser. And man, so let's go ahead and let's start talking about it. Let's share some of this news with everybody. Are you being asked repeatedly to integrate different business systems and ever narrower timeframes with increasing process complexity? What if you could standardize the way you build these business processes so your team are focused on higher value tasks versus the nuts and bolts of running the processes and integrations? Nintex can make that happen. With the Nintex platform, work flows from person to person, system to system, to the cloud and back. Got a custom system you want to connect with? No code extensions let you plug into systems simply and easily using REST and Swagger. With Nintex, work just flows, so your teams can work smarter, work faster, and be more connected than ever. Try it out for free for 30 days at www.nintex.com/trynwc. All right, CJ, let's hold off on the Connect stuff for a second. Let's go through some of the other things that have been big in the news space here, because we've got there was one that was pretty darn big that I know you and I both have some thoughts on, that I heard about this from someone when I was over at the SharePoint conference over in Europe last week. Mm. I didn't expect it to be go public as soon as it did. Maybe it leaked or maybe it wasn't supposed to be public. But Microsoft is throwing in the towel on their Edge browser, but they're not let's temper this a little bit. They're not done with the browsers. They're doing yet another browser, but this time they're going to take advantage and build a browser off of the Chromium project. So what this is Chromium project is an open source browser project that the Google Chrome browser is based on. So it's all the extra stuff around Chrome with like your accounts and a bunch of developer tools and all that stuff. Those are things that are like Chrome specific, but Chromium is the core of the browser, core of the engine. And Microsoft has said, you know what? We're ditching Edge and we're going to build a brand new browser and it's going to be based off Chromium.
It's big news. And I think a lot of people would say this is what Edge should have been to begin with, but that Microsoft's IE team in its hubris decided, no, we're too important for that. We're going to do our own thing again. And that hasn't worked out very well, has it?
Mm-mm, not a bit.
I understand that you're not super excited about this, but I also understand, I've got this crackpot theory that will be proven true or false over time on why they're trying to do this. And my theory is that it's all to do with re-entering the mobile market. Mm. And it's the long play on that. But I tweeted out a thing that said, I'll just read it out. It said, my half-baked theory, Microsoft needs to control a Chromium-based browser so it can deliver a WPA app experience, right? So that's the new progressive web app model for people building websites on its new light version of Windows, which was also rumored to come out, right? Which is this cut-down version of Windows for Chromebooks and the likes. It all accrues to their vNext of their attempt at mobile. This is this time without asking devs to build apps for a nascent marketplace. So my theory is like they've got to control some app delivery mechanism for people building apps using web technologies to their mobile devices, whether that be like a Chromebook or a phone or what have you. And they can't do that with just Chrome by itself, and that they need a wrapper for that. So I think I give it a 1 out of 10 in terms of it, my theory proving to be correct. But I think what they're trying to do is basically give in the towel on saying, hey, we're going to try and make you build these custom apps for mobile platform that doesn't have any users. And we're just going to let you build web apps, and we're going to give you all of the deployment tools you need to do that. And all of the technologies like for offline and authentication and all of the things that you need the browser wrapper part for. But we're not going to make you mess around with our custom layout engine, which you all hate. And so they're going to use Chromium for all the layout and then give devs a way to get apps onto those devices. And that's my half-baked theory about it. And then just for the enterprise, if they want web devs to like them, they're going to have to use Chromium for the layout, right? But the enterprise needs things like tighter security, like GPO, like group policy deployment of certain policies and all that sort of stuff. And so they need to offer enterprises that they don't have with Chrome today. And so I think that could be brought to that audience with this new browser. Whether they call it Edge or not, who knows? But at least I can see why they're doing it. But they don't have a great track record. And so, you know, 9 out of 10 people would say they're going to it up.
Let me ask you something. When you said that whole like Windows web apps or whatever you called them.
WPA?
Yeah, WPA. Is that something different from the thing that Google has been pushing, the community's been working with and making progress on called the PWAs? I know the two letters
thing,
are...
Yeah.
Okay, so same thing. Progressive web app. That's what you meant. Yeah. You meant PWAs.
Did I say PAW, did I?
You said WAPs or WPAs.
Oh, okay, sorry, I meant PWA, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, progressive web app, you know.
Right. So I understand, and it's an interesting theory. I had not considered it until you and I chatted about it. And I mean, I can understand that they need to be able to support things like specific security, like NTLM, Kerberos, TLS2, and all that kind of stuff that maybe they don't have control over making to implement inside the Chrome project. from the Google Chrome. And so they've decided, well, we need to make our own browser. We basically need a Microsoft-controlled version of Chrome, which I get. I think it's, in one sense, so I'm conflicted on this. When I first heard this, I was really negative about it. And I was like, man, I totally expect this to be completely screwed up. You said they have a questionable track record. I think they have a perfect track record. The browser
screwing it up.
Yeah, I mean they won't be batting 100 if they actually get this right.
Can you believe they've gone from like 98% market penetration to almost nothing? Right. Well, not in the public market, right? Not in the public market share. In enterprise market share, IE still dominates, right? But yeah.
It's frustrating. As a web developer, it's frustrating to me that there's yet another browser. I sincerely hope, and I don't know anything about anybody personally or any of the names of who's involved in Edge. So this is not a slam on any one individual or any, you know, whatever, but I really hope it's different people that are implementing this, because I've seen things even as recently with Edge, when they of decisions that they've made or not have made and that have shown their thinking, which really makes me question the people that are behind this. So, like, for example, there's been something that's been a ratified spec for a while as part of the web component spec called custom elements. And all the browsers have implemented this. All the browsers have implemented this standards-based spec. But the Edge team still has it listed on their backlog for the last couple of years of we're still considering it, even though it's one of the most highly voted items that's out there. Mm. And it's part of the web spec. Seeing things on Twitter in the last month or two from someone high up on the Edge team asking a question about what do you think if we had our own, you know, special flavor of CSS that we use that worked in Edge that you could use in your sites. And I saw that and I'm just like, you just don't freaking get it. That's not the way to fix it. You need to find another way to do what you're trying to do. And it's either going after the spec and trying to improve the spec so everybody does the same thing and not trying to say, we know better than everybody else. That's what causes the problem. That's what pisses me off as a web dev. And that's what just gives me no confidence that they're going to do this the right way or they're going to make it the right way. I know all the Microsoft, you know, fanboys are going to go crazy over this and they're going to use the browser right away as much as they make fun of people like me that have like Apple and have a MacBook and have an iPhone and a watch and like, oh, you're an Apple fanboy. It's like, yeah, you're a Microsoft fanboy and you're going to use whatever they give you, including things that are subpar. And I'm sure that this is going to be another one of those. So, I mean, it's yet to be seen on how they implement it. I'm irritated by just saying as a web developer, we don't need another one of these things to deal with. I don't need another freaking browser to do this.
Yep. I'm definitely in agreement on that, that the track record is poor and it's likely to not go very well. But I can see why they're doing it, is I guess what I'm saying. And hey, if they come up with a kick-ass browser that adds a bunch of features and we don't have to rebuild apps just for it, then that's great, but time will tell.
Yeah, and to be clear, people are like, well, yeah, but remember, this is Chromium and it's using the Chrome rendering engine, so you really shouldn't have to do anything with your apps. And I agree with you, but this is the part where I don't trust them to not add their own little special sauce on top of it that's going to cause problems.
Well, so the biggest example of that, I think, is do they use V8 or do they use Chakra JavaScript engine? And in theory, right, it should be you swap it and replace it and everything still works, right? In practice, who really knows? So it's stuff like that, right, I think is what you're saying is like, sure, the layout might be fine, but that's not a layout engine by itself is not a browser.
Mm. Yeah. Now, I'll throw more thing in there. Here's what I hope happens. Now that this news is out and we see this coming, here's what I hope happens. I hope that they nail it. I absolutely hope that they nail it. I hope it's a great new browser that's out there. Mm. And I hope that they do a good job of challenging Chrome, because I get the same Chrome rendering engine. But I hope they do a good job of challenging Chrome. And as a web developer, I see better development tools. The dev tools in Chrome are second to none, in my opinion. I think I like them more than what's in Edge. I like them more than what's in Firefox. It would be great to see someone compete with that and give them a run for the money and not be the only ones out there. It'd be great to see them do something with how Chrome is well known for being a memory hog.
I was just about to say, like, maybe they could do it on a slightly smaller memory footprint.
It'd be great to see that. And if they can do it, then fantastic. I mean, I'm all for that. I'm not saying keep Microsoft out of the business. And it's, you know, the challenge may actually be the thing that Chrome needs, that Google needs to really go through and say, we need to spend more time on optimizing this and, you know, having Chrome go on a diet. It makes everything better. competition is better. I just don't have confidence that they're going to do it. So
yeah, no, fair enough. Proof's in the pudding, right? As we say, yep. But yeah, it's just an interesting move because it finally has taken this long for them to realize we're not going to win with doing our own thing.
Yeah. Hey, okay. So changing the topics here a bit. We're going to get into the news from the Connect event that happened this week. What was that? That was on December the 4th, I think, on Tuesday.
Yeah.
But before we do that, there's a lot of news that's in that event. Some of the stuff is related to Kubernetes, but I want to let you talk a little bit about some other really big Kubernetes news that happened right before or that came out right before Connect.
Yeah. There's a huge vulnerability that got announced in the Kubernetes project, I should say. So I won't read out the CVE number, but you can grab it from the link that we put in the notes. But in it says, with a specially crafted request, users that are authorized to establish a connection through the Kubernetes server API can then send arbitrary requests of the same connection directly to that backend. The vulnerability allows unauthenticated external users access to metrics data provided by the Kubernetes metrics server API by passing a specially crafted payload. There's a bunch of patches for Kubernetes that have come out. And what's in particular is I absolutely crapped myself when I saw this and thought, oh my God, I'm running Kubernetes. I need to do something. And at which point I tweeted, and at which point Gabe Monroy from the AKS team came back and was like, in effect, he said, dude, you're on AKS, it's a managed service, we got you. And that it was already patched before the vulnerability was even announced, which I thought was pretty good, like not having to scramble around. Mm. Really good service, I suppose, having great team running your Kubernetes cluster for you.
Yeah.
But yeah, this basically affects a ton of different Kubernetes versions, 1.10, 1.11, 1.9, actually everything from 1.0 to 1.12.0, there you go. And there's patches for each of the minor versions to upgrade. But yeah, pretty heinous. So the vulnerability was in the API server endpoint and, you know, escalated. You can escalate your privilege basically using it to perform any API request.
Very cool. Yeah, and for those of you who are running Kubernetes, that like you're managing your own cluster, you have to go upgrade your own stuff. But like CJ was just saying that because the AKS is a managed service that Microsoft maintains it, and they're hosting Kubernetes for you. They've taken care of the patch for you, so you don't have to worry about it. I would assume that the Kubernetes service over at Google and the one that AWS provides probably has done the same thing.
Yeah.
I don't know that for a fact, but I would assume that, you know, if you're running a managed service, they've already done it for you.
Yeah. It was just really interesting to see this come out. This kind of made a bunch of waves because it's one of the largest vulnerabilities discovered that gives you sort of root access, so to speak. And Kubernetes is obviously gaining a lot of steam, but with it comes a lot of eyeballs looking at it too.
Struggling to reproduce problems in your code base? Successful software starts with Raygun. Raygun provides application performance monitoring unlike anything that you've experienced before, offering greater clarity around how your software is performing for your customers than any other APM provider. Easily detect and diagnose issues impacting end users and monitor every part of your stack in one place. It's time to get back to building great software instead of fighting it. Start your journey to better software quality and try Raygun for free at raygun.com today.
A 99.9% SLA means you're protected from power outages, bad patches, natural disasters, and maybe even a dinosaur attack. Does it protect you from yourself though? AvePoint Backup for SharePoint Online provides full fidelity backup and recovery from individual items to entire team sites. AvePoint can run backups up to 4 times a day to ensure your data is secure. Recover anytime you want without having to pick up the phone and schedule restore windows. Learn why AvePoint is the Microsoft Cloud expert at www.avpoint.com.
Yeah, that was some big news with Kubernetes, but we've got some additional, not the negative side of the big news, we got some positive big news that all came out of the Connect event. So this Connect event that Microsoft runs usually happens in late part of the year, usually November or December. And what they do is this is when they really announce, like, it's kind of like a mini build the way I see it. It's kind of like a lot of little devy kind of things, usually keynoted by Scott Guthrie. And it's a small in-person event that happens usually in New York City. But they stream it live online, and then you can get access to all the news and stuff. And you and I were taking a look at this. They have a site set up that we're going to link to. We're going to, you know, kind of cherry pick a couple of these different items to talk about here for a few minutes. But yeah, man, they have, it is a ridiculous amount of news that came out. When you, we're not going to link in the show notes every single little thing that we talk about. We're just going to give you a link to the big announcement site. And know that when you see all these announcements too, they are duplicated. So like, for example, the news about containers is in the container section, but it's also in the compute section as well. So you'll find things that are kind of duped up a bit.
Yeah.
But at any rate, there was some, since we just were talking about Kubernetes, why don't we start with some of the Kubernetes
news sure.
here. So,
probably the biggest announcement was Azure have released in preview what they call AKS Virtual Node, or the Azure Kubernetes Service Virtual Node. So in AKS right now, today, before the preview, you provisioned your cluster, your Kubernetes cluster, and you said, how many worker nodes do you want to provision? And in effect, those are virtual machines that get created, right? Those are the things that run your containers. Those are the places where your containers run. And you know, if you're building a system that goes through large peaks and troughs of performance, right? Or load, right? Some days, or maybe for periods of the day, you're under very light load. And then other times of the day, you're under really, really heavy load. Or maybe you've got scheduled jobs that need to run that require a lot of compute, for example. Then it was quite hard to decide how many of these worker nodes you provisioned, right? Because you pay for each of those VMs. The cool part about AKS is you don't pay for the backplane stuff, like the management infrastructure of the cluster, just the worker nodes. But you still had to decide how many of these worker nodes did you want to provision. And so, you know, if you went through spikes during the day, you'd have to provision for those spikes, right? And so you were paying for all this compute that you weren't necessarily using all day. So what they've done is they've been working on this project called Virtual Kubelet for a while now, but now it's supported in AKS in preview. Oh, so I should say not supported. It's been added to AKS in preview. I'm sure it will GA at some point. But what Virtual Kubelet does, or this thing they're calling Virtual Node, is it basically means that you don't have to provision those worker virtual machines behind the scenes. When you need to provision containers and things, you just provision containers and they figure out the compute requirements and getting them up and running on, you know, nodes behind the scenes that you don't really need to worry about. And the cool part is, right, if you've got no containers running, you don't need any compute. And so you're not paying for it. Whereas if you have lots and lots of containers running and it needs lots of compute, they take care of that. And so you get billed accordingly. But you don't have to decide ahead of time how many of these worker nodes to provision. And so it gives you really nice flexibility, you know, if that's what you need for a very price-performant model, I guess, for want of a better word. Yeah. And they're open sourcing this project called Virtual Kubelet so that other providers can do the same sort of thing, I imagine. You may see this in like AWS or Google or somewhere else, but you can go check it out. Virtual Kubelet, it's a open source project that people get to contribute to and all that sort of stuff. So really nice announcement. I think it's one more step towards PaaS again, right? So it's almost like you had to worry about your Kubernetes worker nodes and now you don't need to worry about the actual nodes themselves. You just have to worry about the containers and all that. And it's this sort of slowly sort of chipping back away at getting back to a more PaaS-like model that we may see we get to again in Azure. Well,
it's interesting too. It's a really cool update. I know one of the other things they talked about with the virtual node is that they were donating the project to the foundation, the Container Foundation. But it brings up one big question for me, and that is why would you then create these nodes ahead of time when you could just use this, when you could just use ACI as your one big node? If you could just use AKS and just say, that's the one big virtual node I have, because do I really care to have dedicated machines, or is it that I have specific capacity that I know I'm going to need and I want specific types of VMs to run this? I mean, I thought that, and you know this more than I do, but can I specify on a, when I create the definition for a Kubernetes based application. So like in the pod, I can say that the host needs to have these labels or these properties on it. Like we now see that, you know, part of the news came out from Connect was that Azure Container Instances now have GPU support. Yeah. So if I had a container that was doing some AI stuff, then could I then say, I want to make sure that this is running on a node that's got GPU intensive workloads or is enabled for that kind of stuff?
I guess so. Yeah, I imagine you'll be able to do that and pass additional information to the virtual node infrastructure that, you know, targets specific types of things. Like, it's even simpler than that, right? So at the moment, it's a trade-off, right? With a virtual machine, with a worker node, you get to specifically say, I want it to have this many virtual CPUs and this much memory and these kinds of disks, right? And so you have quite fine-grained control over your configuration, and that might be important for your workload, right? So if you're doing a lot of heavy, even temporary, but heavy I/O with disk and files and things, you might want a specific type of node that can perform better than what the virtual node will give you, for example. Or it could be very CPU intensive, or it could be very memory intensive, or a combination of all of those three. And so with your worker nodes, you get quite a lot of that fine-grained control today. And I just haven't looked deep enough at the virtual node and model yet to know, do you get that same level of control? Or I imagine common sense says to me, there are some trade-offs, right? That you don't get some of that fine-grained control. And so that may not be appropriate for you. The other thing is, like, you know, firing up containers and these things, I imagine it takes a few seconds, right? In Kubernetes today, if you've got a worker node, you could fire up containers in milliseconds. You know, it's not complex or slow, I should say. So there may be also a little bit of performance hit in starting and stopping these things. But really, I need to dig into it more to see what the trade-offs are.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, those are good points. It's, I mean, in one sense, it's kind of bad because it's a little confusing and you don't really know, I have all these options, what should I choose? But in the other sense, it's really good because you've got all these different options and you can choose what's going to make the best sense for your application. So it does, I guess, guidance will be the next thing that we need to start seeing people talk about to get a better idea of, you know, where we're going.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing, right, if you think about Azure Functions, you could argue that, why do you need Azure Functions anymore? Because you could deploy your function as a container and nothing's running in your AKS cluster until you need to run a function and it calls that function and hits it and a container starts to run your function. That's effectively what Azure Functions does, albeit with some abstractions over the top and things. So as you're going and building out a system and you're making these choices, you're going to have even more things to consider, which is the right way to run this code.
Yeah. I guess, you know, another thing just came to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if I was using, with the question I had for you, which is why would I use reserve nodes? And instead, why wouldn't I just go ahead and use AKS with the virtual kubelet and ACI? I can't like pre-define what those domains and everything are of where, if I have specific URLs of where I want to point things to, would that apply to it? Because I know you have reserve nodes and so the path is already defined, or is that something that Kubernetes is going to maintain for me?
Kubernetes already maintains that. The way you get into a Kubernetes cluster from the outside world with an HTTP request is through a thing called an ingress. And that defines listening on this thing externally and I want to route it to this internal Kubernetes service. And your ingress doesn't require compute. The way you define it is not with a container. It runs like an Nginx thing in the background that does the routing, but you could certainly have things that were set up to be externally accessible but not externally accessible until like the container is up and running or what have you. And that could be a timed thing, or it could be something that only happens when requests start or something like that.
Okay.
But yeah, it really depends.
Okay. That kind of thing. That makes sense. Cool. And you mentioned a couple things you mentioned there too, talking about this Kubernetes service and like, you know, question if it even makes sense using functions. Functions actually got some updates too at Connect as well. One of the ones that they got was they've added, so we've had this ability for a while to use something called a durable function.
Yeah, and I heard about those.
What these are, it allows a developer to simplify complex stateful like coordination problems in serverless applications, because you can define a workflow in code instead of using JSON schemas or a visual designer. And what they did as part of the big release at Connect is that they are now announcing support for both Node.js and JavaScript developers. Those developers can now also take advantage of the stuff that C# developers were taking advantage of in functions, which allows you to do things like chaining between different functions. You can fan in, fan out. You can do, or human interaction would be required. So it's not so much of a function like spinning up, running, and going to sleep, a durable function is more of a, think about it more of like a code-based workflow that can like start and stop with different kind of scenarios there. That's one big update that they did to Azure Functions. The other big update that they announced was that the Functions 2 runtime now also supports Python, which is very popular, especially in the machine learning and AI space.
Gotcha. Nice. Yeah, no more Python support.
Yeah.
Python seems to be taking off. I really need to try it out, learn more. I can read it and I can fiddle my way through a script, but I couldn't sit down and write a Python script to save myself.
It's the way I like to describe that to friends is like, I can read it, I can understand it, but when I try to write it, it frustrates the hell out of me because I don't know what I can't figure out what I'm doing.
Yeah, exactly. So,
there was a few other things too that they announced that were related to Functions. There's a new consumption plan for Linux and public preview, and the serverless community also. There's now a library, an open source set of pre-built components based on common use cases using Functions and Logic Apps is now available as well.
Nice. Tons of news actually in the database space, mostly around, well, two things. So Azure Database, have you heard about that? That's like the managed Azure Database for things like Postgres and MySQL. Now they've got a MariaDB version of that available. So you can go provision a managed MariaDB instance, I guess. Is that the right word? Yeah. It just gives more flexibility and options for if you're trying to move apps to Azure, then you can choose between MariaDB, Postgres, and MySQL for those sorts of types of database. Obviously, regular Microsoft SQL Server as well. But also not have to run them on virtual machines and stuff. You can run managed instances yourself. But probably more importantly, there's a ton of news around Cosmos DB, which I think you and I are no secret that we're kind of fans of what they're doing with Cosmos DB. Things like everything from new pricing models, new shared database offers, through to stuff like a new .NET SDK and cause support, which I thought was really interesting. So, you know, if you're trying to do queries to Cosmos DB from a web application, maybe from JavaScript or whatever, then obviously cause is going to come into play, and being able to support cross-origin resource sharing, which is what cause stands for, will let your browser-based app call directly to Cosmos DB for whatever reason, if that's your model that you need. I don't know. Something must have been driving this requirement. I can't imagine ever wanting to call it directly from the browser myself, maybe for internal applications. But anywho, yeah, if you want to call it from a browser or from some JavaScript, you can set up your cause headers to return the correct things. And so your browser will let you do it.
It's interesting because you would think that the right way of doing that you would want to promote is to go through a service that you create, like an API that you create to call your database and not give direct access to the database.
You'd think. But well, somebody's built this for some reason, and I don't know why.
Somebody doesn't want to.
Yeah, I guess so. Maybe internal apps, right, where you've got some sort of, I don't know, you want to build it all in JavaScript and just want to call a service behind the scenes for something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Still, it's great to see lots of momentum on Cosmos DB. It's a really cool service.
There's a bunch of additional news here. I mean, we could go on all day with this too. We've got things like, there's a bunch of AI stuff that's in there, or a handful of AI things and machine learning stuff.
IoT.
Yeah, a ton of IoT stuff that I know nothing about.
Yeah, we should get somebody on the show who's doing a bunch of IoT work with Azure, because there's a lot of services that kind of accrue to the IoT space, like everything from like analytics and monitoring and all that sort of stuff. And it's just not an area that I plan particularly.
Yeah, same here.
If anybody's listening and you're doing interesting IoT projects with Azure as the back end for it, get in touch with us. We might get you on the show and you could talk about what building IoT apps with Azure is like.
Hey, so there's one more thing that I want to throw out there. It's not a Connect thing, but I want to throw it out there before our show gets going too long here. But there was a big bit of news that came out, I believe it was last week, related to Flow and Office 365, specifically around pricing. Now, I don't understand all the details about this, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes so that people can go read up and learn more about it. I know that the people responsible for it have been getting quite a few questions, that might be the nicest way to say it, about this new pricing plan and effectively what they've done. My understanding is that effectively what they've done is they've said now that if you have a Flow that is using a custom HTTP callout, it's either zero or one calls, but anything beyond that, you're going to have a P1 license, which is a huge increase, significant increase in licensing costs. So that now anybody who initiates one of the flow that has a custom connector or the HTTP connector is now going to have a P1 license. So if you got it's a big update. So if you
brutal.
Yeah, it's quite the big change. And I've been watching MVPs talk about it, and there are quite a few people that are pretty pissed off about.
Yeah, that's rough. I guess they're trying to make money with Flow and at least make it a long-term viable business by having it at least be sustainable.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. I understand why they're doing it, but it's a big change.
Yeah, for sure. There is actually one thing we didn't touch on from Connect that we definitely should, which is around .NET Core 3.0. And one of the big bits of news that came with that is that Microsoft are open sourcing WPF Windows Forms and WinUI libraries. Did you ever think you'd see the day?
I didn't. And I didn't. I never thought I would have seen that.
Yeah, you were like, if a tree falls in the woods, does anybody notice? This is a big deal, I think.
That's kind of what I was thinking.
This is a really big deal, man.
Yeah, I know it is.
And the reason I say that is, like, there is a metric beep load of apps built in WinForms and in WPF in businesses and companies. And people are worried about Microsoft's commitment to WPF, for example. And at least this means that, like, if Microsoft gives up caring about it, that the community can keep adding features and can keep supporting it, giving it more legs. But yeah, I think it's a big deal from that perspective, just showing that commitment to that, to like, cool. I hope it's not a move that says we're no longer going to invest in these things and it's up to you now. But if that ever does come, then at least people's investment in WPF apps and WinForm apps and things like that, they can keep building features and fixing bugs. The community can, which should give people a lot more comfort that Microsoft not going to do a hit and run on them.
The way you just said that is kind of how I was interpreting it too. I was a little confused by it, because when I saw that, I was like, it felt to me like Microsoft was like, yeah, you know what? We're not really doing anything more with this, but hey, you guys want to do something with it?
Yeah.
So it almost felt like that. I don't know if that's really fair to say that, but that's at least how it felt like to me when I saw that.
It's possible. Again, it's another one of those time will tell things, but I think there's been a lot of frustration, especially in the WPF space. WPF is actually, I really like building apps in WPF. It's really quite powerful with XAML and things, and it's nice for building native apps, I feel. But, you know, people worry about new features not being added and things, so maybe that will help.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, .NET Core 3 is also coming. There's a first preview of it, which I believe is out or available or something along those lines. So yeah, .NET Core is marching forward pretty nice. Along with more entity framework support and all sorts of stuff like that. So yeah, you can build your WinForms apps in .NET Core 3 now. How about that?
There you go.
I know you're doing a lot of WinForm app development.
I'm going to change my whole afternoon now.
You're going to port all of your React-based apps to WinForms. Getcha.
Exactly. Let me jump back real quick. Let me make sure that let me restate what I was saying too about the flow change. I found I went to the article, and let me make sure I read this out exactly how they said it. It is effective February the 1st, 2019. The following capabilities will only be available with Power Apps in Flow Plans 1 and Plan 2. So the first one is creation and publication of custom connectors in Power Apps in Flow. Second one is HTTP custom actions integrated into Flow outside of SharePoint and OneDrive. And the third one is integration of on-premise data through the on-premise data gateway. Customers with active users of these features will get an automatic extension until January the 31st, 2020, or the expiration of their existing Office 365 subscription term, whichever is longer. Ta-da. That's a big pricing change.
HTTP custom actions.
So that is when, if you don't have a connector that does something you want it to do, then you can drop an action in and you can do some stuff. So for example, I use one of those in a flow that checks every, I think, 15 or 30 minutes. to uses the npmjs.org API to do a request for the current version of the SharePoint framework Yeoman generator. And if it sees that a version, when it gets the result, it checks a SharePoint list and says, what's the current version? And if the version doesn't match the one that is coming back from the API, then I assume that a new version has just been released. And so I send me a push notification to my phone, and I put a tweet out as well saying, hey, there's a new version of the SharePoint framework out. That now would require me to buy a P1 license in order to do that action, where before it did not.
Gotcha. That's, ouchies. That's definitely a, we've included too much in Office 365 for free move.
And we need to make some money.
Yeah. Well, more money, right? Yeah. $7 per user per month for a P1. Yep. That's a lot. Like, yeah. I mean, $7 is not, but if you're a 50,000 user org, that's a lot.
Yeah, because it's not just the person that creates it, it's the person that initiates the flow. So if you've got 50,000 people who could use it, that's 50,000 times 750 times 12 is how much your cost is going to be a year. So,
ouchies. Yeah,
pricey.
Brutal take back.
AC's Voitanos delivers on-demand video-based training for developers on the latest SharePoint extensibility model from Microsoft in his course, Mastering the SharePoint Framework.
CJ's Hyperfish automates the collection of user profile information from users in organizational directories such as Office 365, SharePoint, Active Directory, and HR systems. The secure service supports on-premises, hybrid, and online environments. Bring your directory to life at hyperfish.com.
All right, CJ, we've gone on and on about the news. How about some fun stuff?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, I'll kick us off. I've got two. One is really quick. This is a bit of a surprise to me. I guess it was a mystery that has been answered for me. So as a Tesla owner, you have the ability to give somebody else a referral code. And if they buy a car or they order a Tesla using your referral code, then the person using the code gets a little perk, and the person who did the referral or used whose referral code you used also gets a little perk. And a couple months ago, on the app that I have on my phone, on the Tesla app, you can see a list of all the people who have ordered cars, who have taken delivery of them, and who have also canceled their orders. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten a handful of referrals. In fact, I have enough now to where when they announce a new car, I get an invitation to be there in person when they do the announcement. Now, all of a sudden, about 2 months ago, 3 months ago, I saw a referral show up, but it only showed up as the person's name is G. And about 2 or 3 days ago, I got a message from a guy. I got a message from a guy on Twitter who said, "Thank you for my first week driving around with free lifetime supercharging. I drove from New York City to Western New York to Western North Carolina, $0 in fuel costs. Yep, AC. This is a Tesla Performance Model 3D. So dual engines or dual motors, one on each axle, is one of your referral orders." And I was like, wait a minute. I was like, I didn't know that you used this. I'm like, wait a minute, are you G? He's like, yep, that's who. I'm G. I'm like, I always wondered who that was.
That is so cool.
Yeah, it's a little small world thing there. So it was neat. So I don't know who the gentleman's name is, but I know he's from Asheville, North Carolina. And he goes by the ID, the handle on Twitter as Modern Tri-Dad.
Gotcha. That's so cool. Crazy to think that somebody's bought a car and put in a referral code from the podcast. That's awesome.
That's actually the second one. I don't recognize the other person's name, but I have no idea how to get in touch with them. So I'm not going to read their name out on the show, but everybody else that's bought one using my code, I recognize who they are. So
that's wild.
Yeah. My other pick is about something that I've been using on this last trip, on this trip that I'm on. It's called Luna Display. I freaking love this. So if you have an iPad and if you have I think it works with Windows as well, but I've got a MacBook. You may be familiar with a thing called Duet Display or Duet. And what it does is it uses a lightning cable that you connect to your iPad and then software to communicate between your laptop, either be a MacBook or a Surface or a Windows PC.
I think to your iPad. Looking at the website, they only ever talk about Macs, but maybe there is a...
Well, Luna is, but Duet Display goes...
Oh, sorry, Duet. Yeah, gotcha. Yep.
I've had problems. Duet was great when I first got it, but it started to have a lot of problems with it. It's very, very laggy, very slow. And I think part of it is just because of the tech that they use. what Luna gives you is you install an app both on your iPad and on your Mac, and then you take this little dongle or this little USB stick that's about the size of your thumbnail. And I got the USB-C version, so I just plug it into my laptop, and it uses your existing Wi-Fi connection so that your iPad and your laptop, you can use your iPad as a second screen. And if you don't have a Wi-Fi connection, you can use the lightning cable to communicate between the two. But
so what does the dongle do?
That I haven't figured that out yet, but it must do some sort of a special encoding, a hardware-based encoding that it does to be able to transmit this stuff either over the lightning cable or over Wi-Fi. And the performance of it is much better than Duet. I would notice that with Duet, the screen would get laggy. But what I see now, the only negative I see on the performance on the iPad when I have a screen, when I share the screen, is that sometimes if I'm doing a lot of work, you get that almost like a pixelated view or like a little fuzzy view. Like when you're looking at, you get a bad stream or something when you're watching a video on your phone on a cell connection, and then it clears up like right away. So, but you can still read it. You can still see what's going on. You can still read it. It just doesn't get all laggy where you have like blocks of the page are getting all, out of section, out of area. It's just a little bit fuzzy. The only negative I have on this thing is that that little dongle or that little stick that you stick in your laptop, it sticks out far enough that you can't leave it in your laptop all the time. And it has nothing to where you can connect it to something. So, I mean, this thing is so small, I could swallow this and I don't think I would have a problem. Maybe not. Maybe won't feel that comfortable coming out, but it's not like a USB stick. I mean, it's pretty damn small. So it's
interesting.
I would love to have, I would love it if it had like at least just a little tiny hole on the end of it so I could put like a carabiner on it and I could connect it to something in my backpack. But right now it's in this little bag in my backpack that I'm afraid of losing. So
I really want to know what the dongle does.
Me too. They don't talk about it on the site. It's got to be some sort of hardware encoding.
Must be, but it talks about being able to tap into your Mac's GPU. And so, like, what does the dongle do? I mean, it could just be a security key, which is like, so they don't have to deal with any software licensing. And it's like, it could just be like a security key that you plug in. That's how it does its authentication.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it does its licensing kind of thing. But that seems overkill, like, to do hardware for that. But I'd love to know what it is.
The one thing that this does do that is different from Duet is that it goes both ways in the sense that it will share my screen from my laptop to my Mac, to my iPad. But then on my iPad, I can draw on it. So I can use my iPad as like a writing tablet to be able to like draw sketches in like OneNote or something like that. So I've already used it once when I was doing a presentation and trying to show people how Auth worked. And so I just connected it to it, had my iPad, and I'm kind of walking around the room a little bit using the conference Wi-Fi, and I'm just using my pencil on the iPad. I'm just sketching it out, but I had OneNote up on the screen and people could see what I was sketching out without having to try and use. And I know the people who are on a Surface are like, yeah, well, I've got a touch screen. I can do that with my laptop, and that's all fine and good. But Mac doesn't have that. And I personally don't like touch screens on my laptop. So it's a nice one.
That's pretty sweet. Mm-hmm. Like being able to draw and use it as that almost like a Wacom tablet.
Yeah, pretty much.
Awesome. Okay. I got two kind of big news while I was away in Mexico. Humanity landed again on Mars. Well, not people, but we put another lander on Mars. The InSight lander touched down safely on the Martian surface. And it's the first time it's done so since August 2012, which it's been a bunch of years. But what was cool is you could watch the stream of it all happening, which I thought was pretty awesome. Like you could watch the reaction of people at JPL and all that sort of stuff. It's kind of big news. So this thing, apparently, this lander is going to drill down into the Martian surface quite a long way as well. I think like 5 meters or something.
60 feet or 12 feet. I should have checked.
Yeah, there's quite a difference between those two numbers. Yeah, I thought it was like 5 meters, right? So it's like 15 feet. Anyway, so it's going to drill down, and go, look for signs of water and, what's happened on the planet by drilling down. But yeah, I just thought it was kind of cool. Everybody, it's all streaming it and you could kind of follow along and they had, live feeds and all that sort of stuff, which is pretty awesome. Now, this thing is not a rover, so it's not going to cruise around on Mars like the other ones that we've come to know, like Curiosity and all that sort of stuff. So it's just a lander, right? So it's it just stays in the spot that it stopped and does its business from there.
16 feet, which is 5 meters below the surface, is what it says. Yeah. That's the big piece. And then also it's got seismometers. I thought it was seismometers.
Yeah, that's right.
To be on the lookout for Mars quakes, meteorite strikes, and other jolts.
Yeah, apparently that thing, that its seismometer can detect like insanely small vibrations. Like I remember reading somewhere that, you know, it's like, it's not individual atoms moving, but it's like not far off it. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So yeah, sweet. The other thing, totally different, Micro, the world's smallest travel adapter. It was a Kickstarter project, sorry, an Indiegogo project that I backed a while back, and it finally showed up. I really liked it so much that I forgot that I'd backed it, and I backed it again. So two showed up, one of which I've given away. But yeah, so it's this tiny, tiny international universal travel adapter. Works in over 150 countries around the world and weighs 1.5 ounces. And it has a fuse in it to keep everything safe from surges and all that sort of stuff. But it's pretty sweet. Like, it's all a spring-loaded thing. So all the other ones I've had in the past were quite big. This thing is like, it's tiny. It's incredible.
This is awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet. But yeah, it showed up. You can tell it's sort of V1 of them doing hardware because it's not exactly ultra-high quality. Right. I think V2 of it, they're going to learn from a lot of manufacturing mistakes and issues. And you'll probably get a much higher quality version. But it's pretty sweet. I'm going to travel with it in January and see how it goes. It's pretty nice. Yeah, there's all these little pins that pop out and they're spring-loaded and you can pop them back in. And it deals with Europe and it deals with the US and it deals with Asia. It's pretty good.
Man, this is awesome. I want to get one of these.
Yeah, yeah.
Great find.
I don't know where you buy them, like now that the Indiegogo campaign is closed, but I'm sure there'll be a way to find them. I thought it'd be a nifty, because I'm sure a lot of our listeners are travelers, and I always hate the beginning of a trip going, now, what plugs do I use?
Oh, man.
Wasn't it you that posted on Facebook during your current trip?
Yeah.
Which, like, there's two sets of plugs. I know this is going to be the the naive American and the naive Kiwi talking. But there are like two sets of plugs in Europe that look really, really similar, but are not the same.
Yes. And as much as I appreciate everybody's input, Mike Fitzmaurice was the only one that actually gave me the answer of what I was looking for. When I saw him in Europe, he looked at me and he's like, did you enjoy that Facebook thread? I'm like, no, not really. And he's like, you get the answer you needed? I'm like, yes, from you. So I had posted, because I have a Mac, I also have that Apple travel kit, so you can change the tip on your little PSU to where you can just use the brick and it's just swap it out. It makes it really simple. But then you need something for all the other ones. And I had set the two MacBook ones to one side, and I had set the two tips that I have for my adapter to on the left side. Mm-hmm. And you were supposed to pick a row. You were not supposed to pick a column, because if you pick a column, you're picking both the adapters for the Mac, or you're picking both the adapters for my power supply. And everyone's like, you want the ones on the left. And I'm like, no, they're two different sizes. And they're going, oh, they work everywhere except in this way, except it won't work in the Sweden one, or the Sweden one will not work anywhere else, but it'll work in this one, or Swiss or something like that. And I'm just like, my point is, I don't freaking know which one of these goes with Sweden or Swiss or Switzerland, or I don't freaking know.
Yeah.
So I took them both and I found that the fatter one worked just fine where I was. So, but every time I go to Europe, I end up taking four little tips because I don't ever remember which one's which.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, now go get a Micro. It's universal and compact.
This is interesting.
I'm not affiliated with them at all. I get no kickbacks for this, but it's pretty sweet. You know, even with the kludgy, massive English style monster safety plugs with fuses, you're good with this thing.
Huh. Mm. It says, this is interesting. It says, like, funding was suspended a year ago.
On Kickstarter, but I did it on Indiegogo. So maybe they changed or something happened and they've relaunched on Indiegogo, perhaps. That's where I backed it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll take a look at this.
Actually, cool. I'll switch the link out so it goes to the Indiegogo site, because this one goes to the Kickstarter one, but that doesn't look like the right spot.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll have to try this out and decide would this have worked?
Well, here's the idiot of me. I took all four of those plugs with me. I figured out which one worked where I was in Denmark.
And then lost it?
No, I have it still. Yeah. I just didn't keep track of which one I used. So now I'm just, I was 2 weeks ago.
Now you gotta do this. Brutal.
Go through all the crap again, but anyway, whatever.
It's funny.
Cool.
Cool, man. All right. Well, have a good week.
I will do. You do the same, and we'll catch up again next week.
Sounds good.
All right. Take care, CJ.
See ya.
Did you like this episode? Please tweet about it and drop a 5-star review in iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show, and we'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a WAV or an MP3 and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is brought to you by Keith Ritchie. For more information on Keith's music, head to music.kritchie.com. You can subscribe to us in iTunes and the Google Play Store by searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook, searching for Microsoft Cloud Show, or on Twitter, at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up to our mailing list by heading over to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.